The Supreme Court issued 4-6-3 rulings Tuesday, and taken together, they represent a coherent ideological agenda rather than four separate decisions. The rulings expanded corporate liability protections, curtailed the ability to bring human rights litigation in federal courts, weakened protections for green card holders, and limited inmates' access to sue for civil rights violations. Each ruling individually has defenders who can argue it on legal grounds. All four on the same day, all in the same direction, signals something more systematic about how the current court majority understands its role.
The green card ruling is the one I want to highlight specifically, because it intersects with a separate story today. The court let stand a policy allowing border agents to strip green card holders of their status based on unproven charges, meaning that legal permanent residents can have their status revoked without a criminal conviction, without due process in the traditional sense, based solely on administrative determination. For the roughly 13 million green card holders in the United States, that's not an abstract legal question. That's a direct threat to the stability of their lives.
And then you have Stephen Miller's DOJ memo, which Bloomberg Law reported on today, arguing that states are no longer obligated to provide community-based care for disabled people, directly challenging the 1999 Olmstead decision, which the Supreme Court ruled was required under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The Olmstead ruling was a landmark because it said institutionalization of disabled people who could function in community settings was a form of discrimination. Miller's memo reinterprets that away. Combined with the court's ruling limiting inmate lawsuits, you're seeing a coordinated narrowing of civil rights litigation pathways.
Now, this is a good moment to bring in some legal context, specifically around antitrust, because several of today's business stories touch on it, and I think our listeners deserve a clear foundation. The Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 is the foundational law here. It prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies in restraint of trade, and it prohibits monopolization or attempted monopolization of any market. But here's the crucial thing. Most people get wrong. Having a monopoly isn't illegal under the Sherman Act. What's illegal is acquiring or maintaining a monopoly through exclusionary conduct, behavior that forecloses competition rather than simply outcompeting rivals on merit. Market share alone isn't enough to trigger an antitrust violation. Think of it this way. If you build the best mousetrap and everyone buys yours, you're not a monopolist in the illegal sense. But if you pay hardware stores not to stock any other mousetrap, that's where the law comes in. I'm raising this because Trump's order for the DOJ to investigate oil companies over gas prices sits in exactly this gray zone. There's a real legal question about whether oil company pricing coordination, if it exists, constitutes restraint of trade versus oil companies each independently responding to market signals.
That's exactly the right frame for the oil investigation, Sarah. Trump ordered the DOJ to investigate oil companies over gas prices Tuesday. Politically, the timing is obvious. His approval numbers are near record lows, and gas prices are a visceral economic signal for voters. The Pennsylvania rally he held Tuesday, where he was touting the economy despite polls showing his approval rating in the low 30s, illustrates the disconnect. The challenge legally is precisely what you described. Proving coordination versus parallel behavior in a commodity market is notoriously difficult.
The California primary story is arguably more legally explosive. Trump said publicly, not leaked, he said it himself, that he called a U.S. attorney to intervene in Steve Hilton's gubernatorial primary. The president claiming credit for directing federal prosecutors toward a specific political outcome is a direct challenge to DOJ independence norms that date back to the post-Watergate reforms. The fact that he's volunteering this information suggests either that he doesn't view it as problematic or that he views the norm itself as worth challenging publicly.
And then there's the Republican Party fracture. Marjorie Taylor Greene joining Tucker Carlson in formally breaking with the GOP is less about their individual positions and more about what it signals for the populist nationalist wing of the coalition. Greene has been threatening this for months. If this represents the beginning of an organized political realignment rather than individual grievances, it has real consequences for Republican majorities in both chambers heading into the 2028 cycle.
The Pew Research numbers are worth sitting with here. 23% global confidence in Trump's leadership across 36 nations, with half of respondents in those countries now calling the U.S. an unreliable partner. For American businesses operating internationally, for treaty partners depending on security commitments, for diplomatic negotiations, that number has concrete operational meaning. Not a single country in the survey viewed Trump more favorably than a year ago. Not one.